You were standing there representing a union whose members have been on strike for a fortnight in defiance of the agreement, the act, and your union's own rules, said Senior Commissioner Eric Kelly of the Industrial Relations Commission. The reply, it does not take just today or half an hour for an official to go to site and suddenly convince with rhetoric workers to return to work. It can take a considerable period of time. So that was a reply from Colin Hollett, full-time Pilbara organiser for the AMWSU, the Metal Workers Union. So in the Pilbara iron ore industry, in the mining region of WA in the 1970s and 1980s, rank-and-file workers were powerful. They struck regularly, they won good pay and conditions, they had some level of control over hire and fire, over staffing levels and over safety. And, crucially for this talk, they clashed regularly with union officials. The Marxist theory of the union bureaucracy and rank and file argues that there's a difference of interest between union officials and rank and file workers, and that union officials have a contingent conservatism, which I'll sort of come back to that. But this theory has informed the union work of many thousands of socialist workers over the years, particularly those from the international socialist tradition. But it's rarely, I think, been, kind of looked at in a lot of depth. The theory has implications for socialist strategy, and it's always been, somewhat controversial on the left. So what I'm going to do in this talk is set out the theory as I see it, then objections to it, because there's been some recent but also long-running debate, both in academia among activists. But we also need to look to the actual activities of workers and unionists to test out, I think, if a theory works. So I'm going to use trade unionism in the Pilbara iron ore industry over many decades as a case study for this. It's something that I've researched for a number of years with my PhD. So the talk's got three parts. So one, I'll set out the theory. Then I'll apply it to the case study of the Pilbara. And then thirdly, I'll look at challenges to the theory and smash them, hopefully. So in terms of trade unions in general, Karl Marx was the first leading socialist to support trade unions on principle, and he called them class organisations of the proletariat par excellence. The very existence of trade unions reflects the counterposed interests of workers and bosses. Unions are associations of workers that use the ability to withdraw workers' labour, workers' labour power, to put pressure on the bosses. So the existence of trade unions impinges on the absolute authority of management in the workplace. So there's a long history of the capitalist class trying to smash unions, which, continues to this day. Workers can mobilise through unions and win gains, but unions are still defensive organisations which operate within the parameters set by the capitalist exploitation of workers. Unions started to form very early on in the UK and Australia, very early on in sort of the history of capitalism, and started off being much more informal. But very quickly, and certainly today, unions are mass organisations, usually with large bureaucracies, with big assets and legal recognition. Their goal is to preserve or to extend workers' wages and conditions within the capitalist system. It's not to overthrow the capitalist system. And so unions at once articulate and fight for workers' grievances and confine them to capitalism. So in this sense, they institutionalize the irreconcilable conflict between workers and employers. Unions have got internal rules, and they're also subject to rules enforced by the capitalist state. Though it must be said, these rules and laws aren't followed by all workers all of the time. Unions engage in collective bargaining by union representatives. And in this bargaining, both sides recognise the terms of engagement. And trade unions reduce the scope of workers' demands to what is easily formulated in negotiation. So, for instance, wages and conditions are much easier to negotiate on than some of the more kind of amorphous grievances that workers can have. So, you know, the desire for stimulating, fulfilling work or more control over your labor, independence from management. You know, these aren't the kinds of things you can put in an enterprise bargaining agreement, you know, or even the desire to get rid of capitalism itself. So now I'm going to talk about the trade union bureaucracy, because I think the bureaucracy really personifies the contradictions that are inherent in trade unionism under capitalism. The union bureaucracy consists of union officials and their advisors. So everyone, right from the ACTU secretary, right down to your local union organiser, and including all the other union sort of industrial officers and staffers. So it's wrong to argue that the theory of the trade union bureaucracy mainly or primarily applies just to a few dozen union officials at the sort of the head of the union movement, national union officials. This is something that Ralph Darlington and Martin Upchurch, who are industrial relations academics in the UK and part of the Socialist Workers' Party, they sort of do that. But I think it's important to recognise that, you know, this theory kind of applies to all full-time union officials. So the union bureaucracy's role in society is really unique. It is to negotiate the sale of workers' labour power to bosses. The role of the union bureaucracy then is to manage discontent, to resolve problems, to process workers' grievances through the proper channels, to strike a deal. Trade union officials form a distinct social layer with distinct interests to rank and file union members. Fundamentally, I'd argue there's a dichotomy between them and rank and file workers. So union officials are not exploited, unlike workers. They're paid their wage from union funds, which ultimately comes from union members' dues. Officials don't share their members' working conditions, and at most they'll be affected indirectly by a deal which, you know, for instance, intensifies work, lowers pay, or brings in redundancies. Contrasting union officials to the capitalist class, though, they don't get their income through exploiting workers. They don't, they don't exploit workers. So it's usually the union bureaucracy that formulates demands and bargains on behalf of union members. And so they are the ones most subject to the pressures towards compromise, which I think are inherent in trade unionism itself. So the trade union bureaucracy has a contingent conservatism. I think this was coined by Tom Bramble, a comrade in Brisbane. So the conservatism is twofold. So one is in the demands sought, and then secondly in the action desired to get them. So the union bureaucracy is caught between capitalism's two opposing classes, the capitalist class and the working class. So it comes under pressure from both directions. But as a general rule, the union bureaucracy will prefer to take the proper channels. So taking disputes to the Industrial Commission, the Fair Work Commission now, and the courts, lobbying politicians, public relations campaigns, election campaigns, all of these kind of methods over militant strikes. When strikes are occasionally called for, the bureaucracy prefers them to be short, legal, and controlled by itself. However, it can come under pressure from a militant working class during a period of heightened class struggle. And in these circumstances, it can sanction strikes all the better to kind of wind them down. So the union bureaucracy can sort of ride the tiger of union of militancy. So the extent of their conservatism is contingent on the balance of class forces at the time. The union bureaucracy, you know, obviously has an interest in achieving some results for their members. You know, if you're a union official, you don't kind of do something or seem to do something, you can lose office in union elections, you can face members resigning and so forth. Or in a period of social upheaval, so, you know, you think of the late 60s and early 70s, a failure to act can mean that rank and file militants just bypass official union structures and organise strikes themselves. So the union bureaucracy have an interest in both sanctioning action and placing demands on employers to a degree, you know, to the extent that they at least won't face as much challenge from their ranks. So all of this is a way of saying you can't just reduce union officials to, you know, agents of the employers. So rank and file workers exert pressure on union officials. From the other direction, the employers and the state exert and can exert immense pressure on the bureaucracy to call off industrial action and to settle for less. The state can threaten or apply legal sanctions such as fines on the union, even its officers and members, and can deregister a union. And employers also have legal avenues that they can bring pressure to bear on the union bureaucracy. So union officials are acutely aware of the need to compromise in order to guarantee continuing recognition as a legitimate bargaining partner. This then informs the strategy and tactics adopted by union officials. So the way that this mediating role between capital and labour influences union officials' actions isn't always straightforward. Pressure from bosses can actually push officials towards militant action if union recognition is at stake. And union officials have agency and a degree of autonomy from all the other actors in the picture, you know, workers, employers and the state. Also, the trade union bureaucracy isn't just a homogenous block. So they differ among themselves in terms of strategy, tactics, and political sympathies. So, you know, in Australia, you think of the difference between, say, the left-wing and fairly militant Maritime Union of Australia, or the MUA, right through to the notoriously conservative pro-management leadership of the SDA, the Shop Distributive and Allied Employees Association. But to quote Tom Bramble here, despite these differences, the structural position of trade union officials within capitalism sets limits on even the most militant of them, end quote. Left-wing and militant union officials can play a role in winning support for union strategies that more industrially quiescent and conservative officials are incapable of, because left-wing officials can have the allegiance of more militant sections of the working class. So here the classic example is the left-wing metal worker union, the AMWU, their advocacy of the class collaborationist, corporatist, if you like, prices and incomes accord in Australia in the 1980s. Very briefly, you know, a deal between the Australian Council of Trade Unions and the ALP government, effectively committing unionists never to strike in return for more influence over government policy and a so-called social wage. In this period of the accord, strike levels plummeted and real wages declined. But the left-wing metalworkers union with strong Communist Party influence was essential because, you know, key sections of the working class had an allegiance to them that the right-wing officials simply didn't have. And in the UK, a very similar phenomenon happened a little bit earlier in the 1970s, where left-wing union officials supported the very similar social contract in the 1970s. Hierarchies within unions can also affect the degree to which union officials are subject to pressure. So at the highest level, the ACTU secretary, you know, currently Sally McManus, or a union national secretary, they're extremely removed from work on the ground and spend far more time with politicians, bureaucrats, industrial commissioners, and so forth, even capitalists sometimes, than workers. Then right at the bottom of the kind of union bureaucracy pecking order, a union organizer can interact with members, you know, depending on the union, can interact with members on an almost daily basis. And so union organisers would tend to be more responsive to rank and file pressure and less likely to sort of instinctively adopt conservative strategies, you know, as a rule of thumb, So, you know, if you see union officials as kind of caught between the two opposing classes, workers and capitalists, it would make sense that, you know, the closer you are to one of those classes, the more you're going to, they're going to impact on your behaviour. But these tendencies can be mediated by other factors. So in the case of union organisers, a lot of the time in Australia, they're appointed by, so they're not elected, but they're appointed by senior union officials and can be disciplined by them. So, you know, if you sanction a strike or do a particular thing, you can just be sacked. So this reduces their scope for militancy. So I think these the social position and the negotiating role is key to understanding the union bureaucracy. There's also two additional factors, which I think are secondary but still kind of worth mentioning, that shape their behaviour. So one is material privileges or the kind of prospect of them later in life. And then the second is support for social democratic parties like the Australian Labor Party, the ALP. So trade union officials never want to threaten Labor's electoral prospects by too much industrial action. And this is worse when the party is in office. And the Labor Party in Australia is, you know, has a link to the trade unions and the union bureaucracy in that most Australian trade unions are affiliated to the party and entitled to 50% of votes at Labor Party conferences. Many trade union officials hold party membership and some are party office bearer positions, or many actually, party office bearer positions. And a significant number of Labor MPs are former union officials. The right loves to bang on about this. I actually got these statistics from the Institute of Public Affairs. So in 2015, 19 out of 26 national executive members of the ALP were current or former union officials. And that same year, 40 out of 80 federal Labor politicians were formerly union officials or union staffers. So all of this, I think, increases a tendency towards compromise and away from confrontation with big business and the state on the part of the union bureaucracy. But like I say, I think this is secondary. So, you know, for instance, in the 60s and 70s, sometimes union officials belonging to the Communist Party weren't more militant than their peers, you know, holding ALP membership cards. Another way of thinking about it is to look at the US. US union officials, you know, aren't part of a Labor Party. They don't have a Labor Party, and yet are notoriously conservative. The material position of union officials also shapes their outlook. So, you know, union officials' conditions differ from members on the shop floor, you know, and varies between the union, but sometimes quite dramatically. So union officials aren't, if you're talking about, you know, blue-collar industries, they're not out working in the heat, you know, not at risk of dying on a building site. If members take a pay cut or there are redundancies, these generally won't affect the union officials. So they only will affect the union bureaucracy to the extent that they affect the union as a body. So, okay, you know, if a union loses thousands of members, maybe at that point they'll start, you know, getting rid of union officials. But, you know, it's always one step removed. The conditions that are negotiated for workers on their behalf are not, the same conditions that the officials enjoy. And this divergence in conditions, you know, occurs even when officials have come up from the rank and file of that union, though it has to be said this is increasingly rare in Australia. Then in terms of their salaries, again, varies greatly, but union officials' salaries can often be much more than the workers they represent. It's common for state secretaries and national officials to earn northwards of $200,000. So Aaron Owlich, Victorian branch secretary of the Australian Education Union, earns $201,000 a year. David Hancock, national senior vice president of the AWU, earns $219,000. So, you know, these kinds of figures make it more likely that they'll see management's point of view or even, you know, move in the same kind of social circles as them. For union officials that don't rock the boat during their career, they, you know, have lucrative careers later on as Labor politicians, like we've seen, industrial commissioners, even representatives of big business. So three former secretaries of the Australian Council of Trade Unions, ACTU, are now senior business representatives. So Simon Crean, chair of the Australian Livestock Exports Council, Martin Ferguson, chairman of the advisory board of the Australian Petroleum Production and Exploration Association, and, you know, Bill Kelty's on something or other. Again, though, this isn't the determining factor. So in a, you know, historical example, in the 1917 Great Strike in Australia, many unions had no full-time officials, but union officials still acted to sort of bring an end to that strike. All right. Can you just give me every 5 minutes? Oh, thanks. All right. So case study of the Pilbara. So ultimately, a theory, I think, can... Oh, yeah, that's a good slide for the part that's whizzed past. Ultimately, a theory can only be tested by applying it. So the case study here from my research is the Pilbara iron ore industry from the mid-60s to through to 1987 with the Robe River dispute. So in... great. So from 65 to 72, there was a period of union growth, union establishment and growth in the emerging mining region. So in 1960, this is a Pilbara region in the northwest of WA. Comrades here will be familiar with it. Maybe not so much here. Yeah. Eastern Staters. So anyway, there's basically this bonanza of development and exploration and construction. So of new iron ore mines. So by the end of the 1960s, there were 8 new towns, a new port, and thousands of kilometres of railway track and roads laid down in the Pilbara region. The union bureaucracy did not want to be cut out of this new industry. So union officials, as well as rank and file members, played mobilising roles in fighting for union recognition. Initially, there was low pay, poor conditions, managerial authoritarianism, and low safety standards. So, you know, just one example, the food, they used to have what they called Pullman's power packs, which is basically soggy lettuce and tomato and cheese in a just, you know, plastic bag that's kind of melted. You know, that was the food you were given. But trips north from Perth-based union officials played an important role in unionising the region. So typically union organisers would go to the Pilbara for a few weeks, visit sites, sort out grievances, sign up members and get shop stewards elected. Rank and file union activists also played an important role. The union bureaucracy, though, played a contradictory role even in this early stage and directed workers to stop striking on multiple occasions. The 1969 Iron Ore Award gave very limited recognition to shop stewards. Now, interestingly, the companies themselves requested this clause so that they could gain some level of formal control over the growing power of the shop stewards. Concerned that their negotiating role not be usurped, some union officials opposed this limited clause for recognition of shop stewards. For the union bureaucracy, the bargaining over wages and conditions should be the preserve of union officials. The ACTU wrote that, quote, "the legitimate activities of shop stewards and shop committees are the creation of unity among workers and the dissemination of information." So essentially, we make the rules and policy and you disseminate it. So in this early period, strikes and organising over a number of years improved paying conditions and established union structures. The union bureaucracy played a vital role in this, but there were tensions between rank and file unionists and union officials, which then intensified in later decades as grassroots union representatives increased their own authority and influence as compared to the union officials who were based primarily in Perth. So in this next time period, So from about 1973 to 1986, I'd basically call this a period of union power. Unionism was strong, it was militant, it was well organized, and it was grassroots led. Every work area on all of the mine sites and ports had a shop steward. For every 10 or so shop stewards, there was a convener. The conveners often were paid by the, they were always paid by the company, but they spent more and more time on union affairs until a lot of them were full-time. So full-time on union affairs, but paid by the company, which I'll come back to that. Strikes were frequent. Pay and conditions improved enormously. Workers often exercised influence or controlled, as I mentioned, hire and fire, staffing levels, housing, safety. And unionism was characterized by a level of independence from and distrust towards the union bureaucracy by the rank and file. All right, so there's this fantastic example of these tensions in 1974 at Mount Newman Mining. In January of that year, 58 site representatives, so representatives of all 10 mine sites and ports and all 9 relevant unions flew to Perth to negotiate with the then four mining companies alongside union officials. Some union officials described being, quote, provided an avalanche of handwritten notes to their respective union officials. Sorry, I've butchered the quote. Essentially, the shop stewards are giving the union officials an avalanche of handwritten notes throughout the proceedings, thereby tending to disrupt and fragment the negotiations. The officials said that they, quote, felt inhibited by the presence of site union reps and that their bargaining positions had been compromised. The agreement was ratified by all unions at all sites except for 2 unions at one of the mining companies, Goldworthy Mining. 142 Goldworthy workers went on strike for 3 weeks against the agreement. They were sacked. The strikes spread to other companies and the workers were later reinstated and paid back pay for the time on strike. But the tensions between the rank and file and the bureaucracy were not resolved. And in 1975, they boiled over and workers at at Mount Newman Mining struck to demand more representation for shop stewards conveners on the negotiating committee. So they caused $400,000 in lost production to the company over an issue that was actually an internal union dispute with, the company sort of, depending how you look at them, kind of innocent bystanders in this. Not innocent, but bystanders. Another example is the Hammersley Iron Dispute of 1979, a 12-week dispute where Hammersley Iron recognised the power of the conveners, workers who were full-time on union business but based at the mine sites and paid by the company. And the company Hammersley Iron, which is now Rio Tinto, were prepared to offer them some recognition, official recognition, albeit with the aim of trying to, kind of incorporate them and blunt union militancy. AMWU state official Jack Marks, the notorious Back to Work Jack, publicly criticised the company for financing the attendance of grassroots unionists at Perth negotiating meetings. Industrial relations academic Norm Dufty argues, and he's not a left winger, Hammersley's policy of encouraging site union representation in negotiating agreements had long been a point of friction between full-time officials in Perth and their site representatives. And he refers to an alienation of the site union representatives from the full-time officials. During the dispute, union officials squared off against the rank and file. AWU shop steward Harry Hoskin remembers a mass meeting that AWU official Charlie Mitchell spoke at. He got up and he starts carrying on as though he's apologising on behalf of Hammersley Iron. Well, they've got 8 ships on the harbour. I grabbed the fucking microphone and I said, Charlie, are you working for us or are you working for Hammersley fucking Iron? I said, we don't care if we have 80 ships out there, the more the merrier. Your job is to negotiate on our behalf. And this is back to Harry. I got a standing ovation. After the meeting, Charlie came up and got a hold of me and said, "Hey, what was that all about?" I said, "Oh, well, sometimes you've got to be given a prod, Charlie." I'll just leave it on that. So the biggest unions in this kind of period, 70s and 80s in the Pilbara, the biggest unions, the AWU and the AMWSU, had a maximum of 3 organisers each based in either Port Hedland or Karratha. So these are huge numbers, you know, considering the vast distance. Like the Pilbara is sort of like as big as Victoria, and it's hundreds of kilometres between each mine site, between the mine sites in places like Port Hedland and Karratha, and it's over 1,100 kilometres from Perth. So these, obviously these organisers are still close to the action than the Perth-based officials, but they're not that close and they're not very numerous. So, but by the late 70s, at least the larger unions on the larger sites had these full-time conveners paid by the company but fully engaged on union business. And this arrangement was imposed on management reluctantly. So at Robe River, when asked how the AWU convener, Dave Dawkins, became full-time, someone I interviewed, Peter Hollow, said he just fucking told them he wasn't going to do it any other way. Thanks. So this arrangement having the being based on the site, paid by the company, but having all of your time dedicated to union, organising and agitating, gave conveners a large degree of power if backed up by the rank and file, and provided an alternative locus of power to the trade union officials. Conveners were central to the exercise of union power and continue to play an important role in this period. And I think they're best viewed as part of the rank and file because their power was dependent on a militant and organised, rank and file. The very existence of these conveners was dependent on the efforts of the rank and file in the first place. Whereas with officials, they're kind of one step removed, that the union decides whether they're employed or not. With conveners, by contrast, the balance of forces between grassroots unionists and the company can be critical in deciding whether they even exist. So the full-time nature of the union role for some conveners, though, could suggest that they're part of the bureaucracy. That's arguable, but I think the fact that they're paid by the company and can have their privileges, their rights withdrawn by it points to them being considered part of the rank and file. So they can be sacked or made redundant by management where union officials cannot. So their position is much more subject to the rhythms of class struggle than is that of the union bureaucracy. So I think the best categorisation of conveners is as part of the rank and file, while noting, though, that they can be subject to some of the same pressures as union officials. Having said that, though, companies can and try to co-opt conveners. Sometimes they did this successfully in the Pilbara, and in other times and places, companies can find it useful to pay a pliant union representative who's based at the workplace. Goldsworthy manager... Goldsworthy manager Derek Miller made an insightful and revealing comment which reinforces the analysis that conveners are separate from the union bureaucracy. And I think I find this especially interesting as it came not from a unionist or an academic, but from a manager. So in response to an interviewer's question about whether in the future union officials would have less and less of a say at the company, Miller replied, "I don't see that. I see us still maintaining a strong position for the state union officials. I would see that as a matter of principle with us. There is still a degree of responsibility in state union officials that is not necessary in the local convener. I wouldn't like to get to the situation that some people have been in where the union official has wiped their hands of him because you've done all the deals with the local bloke and not kept the state union official informed. When it comes to the crunch, he's the bloke that can exert some discipline." So in the late 70s, Goldsworthy Mining introduced this corporatist program where in return for not striking, or maybe not striking, but in return for kind of not striking as often and not having that as the first kind of port of call, which it really was for Pilbara unionists in this period, unionists would be given a seat on regular joint committees with the company. And so Herb Thompson, a left-wing academic, noted of this that publicly both union officials and management representatives said the program was a success in reducing the level and intensity of disputation. From the beginning, most conveners clearly understood they were being used by the company in Perth. Sorry, being used by the company. Union officials from Perth, on the other hand, were quite glowing in their praise for the program. Not only were they wined and dined every 3 months, but their workload was reduced considerably in an area where they normally face innumerable thankless tasks. And the Robe River dispute, moving on now to this is the first unionized company in the Pilbara that was smashed. Which then kind of led the way for the others to also be smashed. You may have noticed that there is not militant unionism in the Pilbara iron ore industry today, unfortunately. So the Robe River dispute in 1986-87 was an all-out attack on workers and unionism at what was then the most militant of all the iron ore companies. And everyone at the time saw the broader significance that if this domino falls, it could happen anywhere in Australia. The new management ripped up all of the union agreements struck in the last 10 years, abolished the convener position, called for hundreds of redundancies, abolished safety standards, and the so-called restrictive work practices. So basically said, we want total control. The union bureaucracy mobilized to ensure that the workforce didn't strike in response to this all-out attack. So union officials urged the workforce not to take any strike action. Even though the immediate reaction of all the shop stewards and workers was to strike, you know, which had served them so well, the union bureaucracy convinced, workers not to strike. The Trades and Labor Council today, Unions WA, got involved, centralising all the money. Previously, they'd had all these kind of strike funds in the Pilbara that were administered by grassroots unionists in the Pilbara, which gave them some independence. So this was all kind of centralised and spent on lawyers rather than a strike fund. And then in the dispute, the Seamen's Union showed solidarity by refusing to load the ore and defied the union bureaucracy, but the union bureaucracy went into full swing to get the ships to sail. So every state secretary of the relevant unions was flown up. The company, Robe River, provided them with facilities to address workers, and union officials like Jack Mark slandered workers on strike, wanting to strike, as company stooges, agent provocateurs, told workers they'd lose their homes and basically narrowly won a vote. So, I think the collaboration here between the company and union officials is noteworthy given the anti-union position of the company. So union power was decimated at Robe River and hundreds of workers left the Pilbara. So, you can really see the conservatism of the union bureaucracy opposed to militant tactics such as indefinite strikes, willing to negotiate away key conditions built up over many years. And the fact that this took place during the accord meant that officials were especially keen to present the unions as moderate, industrially responsible, and so forth. And the dispute was a chance for the union bureaucracy to reassert their control over an unruly workforce and over conveners who had usurped some of their power. All right, so now I want to look at some attacks on this theory of the trade union bureaucracy from the left. So industrial relations academic and self-described socialist John McElroy in 2014 was kind of the latest to make a semi-coherent attack on the theory, but these kind of go back to at least the 70s. McElroy's central argument is there's no fundamental dichotomy between the bureaucracy and the rank and file. He says it's only during a revolutionary crisis that there is a significant division between the bureaucracy and rank and file. And I quote, theory claims and history confirms outside a developing crisis and the emergence of an influential revolutionary party, experience of exploitation does not significantly contribute to a division within trade unionism with the bureaucracy on one side and members and shop stewards, some of whom daily confront bureaucratic pressures at work, on the other. I mean, people can disagree, but I think this claim is simply unsustainable with relation to Pilbara unionism in the 70s and 80s. Probably running out of time. I'll leave that quote up if you want to read rather than listen to me. These divisions, I think, between the bureaucracy and rank and file can be clearer during high points in struggle. But their existence, the sort of the dichotomy between the rank and file and the union bureaucracy, means we need to emphasize building a socialist political current in the rank and file, and one that looks to workers' own power and understands the interests and role of the union bureaucracy. So this is both for the sake of union struggle now and also to prepare the groundwork for bigger battles in the future. And I might come back to that in the sum up, or people can, you know, discussing the discussion, you know, how this might apply today, even when there's not a high level of struggle as in the Pilbara in the 70s. McElroy argues that bureaucracy pervades the union movement from top to bottom. So he concedes that its greatest pressures are on professionals, leading officials, national, regional, and local staff, and full-time executive members. And McElroy sort of sets up a straw person argument, saying that advocates of the theory refer to, quote, an embedded conflict of interest between a conservative privileged bureaucracy and a radical militant rank and file. So essentially saying that, you know, we're crude and talk up how left-wing the working class is in order to downplay the problems of economism and trade union consciousness. McElroy emphasizes that there are big differences within the trade union bureaucracy and within the rank and file. There are political differences within the rank and file. But so what? Some union members are liberal voters. The existence of a low level of consciousness among some or even many workers at a particular point in time, and the existence of some officials who can talk left or call strikes, does not say anything about the structural features of the union bureaucracy. And it's worth pointing out, you know, it's very common for reformists and union officials to, you know, really shit on their members and just talk about how backwards all of their members are, which I think, you know, is really appalling and is often used as an excuse for their own inaction and lack of leadership. So we shouldn't overstate that, but clearly it is the case that, you know, not all union members all of the time are left-wing or militant or class consciousness. The fact that bureaucracy pervades the whole of the union movement doesn't invalidate the thesis. So there are bureaucratic pressures placed on, you know, shop stewards, union delegates. And in periods of low class struggle, these can be quite intense. But shop stewards are workers, are paid this, you know, have the same paying conditions as their fellow workers. They're exploited. They use struggle and unions as an instrument to improve their lives. The trade union bureaucracy, though, is a different social layer who negotiates the sale of labour power. And so their role as negotiators in the bargaining relationship means that emphasis is on a deal, striking a deal, and not on struggle. Strikes can be an inconvenience that can rapidly escape their control. And by shop stewards organising collectively in rank and file networks, they can mitigate against some of these bureaucratic pressures that apply to them. And I think, you know, the experience of union struggles in the 60s and 70s, you know, across Australia, the UK, and, you know, many other countries is testament to this. Yeah, and so just to like reiterate the different kind of interests, interests of trade union officials are really confined to their place in the bargaining relationship. And the continued viability or the perceived continued viability of their organisations, the trade unions. Workers' interests, on the other hand, are improving their pay, conditions, quality of life, and for some actually, fighting to get rid of capitalism altogether, regardless of the impact of this on the unions as organisations or the officials' position within it. So to sum up very briefly, this theory helps us to analyse trade unionism today and historically. It provides a materialist analysis of why officials so often push things in a more conservative direction and sell out struggles. And it is a guide to action. We need to build an alternative leadership to the trade union bureaucracy. We need to orient to rank and file self-activity in the trade unions. But we're not syndicalists. Economistic militancy is not enough. This worked for a time in the 1970s, but the downturn of the mid-1970s and the election of a Labor government alongside, the union bureaucracy through the Price and Incomes Accord, which was committed to wage cuts and no strikes, these circumstances, these kind of negative external circumstances, required a political response and a large revolutionary left in the unions. It's interesting when you kind of look at, some of the material from this period, I get the sense a lot of workers didn't like the accord, but there wasn't an organised political grouping that could successfully challenge it. Okay, so look at it the other way. If you think there's no dichotomy between the rank and file and the trade union bureaucracy, well, why organise? Why place so much of an emphasis on organising among the rank and file? If union officials are so left-wing, why build a separate revolutionary grouping? Why not simply run for union office or rely on left-wing officials to improve things? When we look at history, when we look at the social position of union officials, there's a dichotomy and a clear tendency towards conservatism on the part of the officials. The strategic consequence of that is to build strong rank and file organisations that are independent of union officials and to build a revolutionary socialist organisation with clarity on these questions that can play a role in organising workers around class struggle unionism.